You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Canada's ambassador to Iran, Ken Taylor, was hailed as a hero for his role in hiding six Americans during the 1979 occupation of the American embassy in Tehran. Under his protection, they were safely returned to the United States after only 3 months. The 52 hostages would remain captive for 444 days. Last year, declassified cables between Mr. Taylor and the Canadian and U.S. governments revealed that the ambassador not only provided a safe haven for the Americans and appeared to be operating as a de facto CIA station chief of the U.S. These cables and the story of his role in intelligence gathering are the subjects of a new book by historian Robert Wright called Our Man in Tehran. It's published by Other Press, and I'm pleased that it brings its subject, Ken Taylor, to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you went to Tehran as Canadian ambassador in 1977, hadn't you had your pick of countries to go to? Why did you choose Iran?
No, it's sort of a competitive business if you're back in Washington or Ottawa as to where you go or where maybe you're lucky enough to be sent to. Tehran, when I was hoping to get abroad, which would have been roughly 76, 77, was a place to go. Its growth was explosive. It was on good terms, you recall, with the United States, and it saw itself as a regional superpower.
So you saw it as a place where you could encourage trade, for example. After all, it's a great source of oil.
Yes, everybody wanted a piece of Tehran. There were roughly 85 embassies there, and primarily for trade and economic reasons.
But weren't there already indications that dissidents were gaining momentum in their efforts to remove the Shah?
There were. But most of us in Tehran thought that the Shah would ride it out. A subtle change of government, a million-man army.
Mm. In his book on this story, Robert Wright says that President Jimmy Carter's visit to Iran on the 1978-1979 New Year's Eve changed everything in the country. Did you attend that event?
No, it was primarily the Iranians. And the American delegation. It was, of course, one of the major events of the year. And the president's words to the Shah at that time were well publicized.
And why did he make the trip, and what did he say to the Shah?
He was doing a regional trip. I think he'd gone to India or Pakistan or Saudi. It was a part of a three-stop trip. And at that time, the Iran was still seen as a strategic ally of the United States. His words, he thought, would strengthen that relationship, despite the fact that there was a certain amount of uneasiness and tension in everyone's perspective of Iran at that time.
Well, Iran had reasons to be angry with the United States for something that had happened within the memory of some of the people who were there. Actually, I think probably the British more than the United States, but there was the 1953 CIA-backed coup that ousted Prime Minister Mossadegh. Was that a cause of resentment still?
Yes, it was an undercurrent. It largely, people tended to put it back behind them, but it was still very much upwards in the mind of the Iranians. In a sense, it was their first try at democracy. And Mossadegh was a character. He was seen by many as eccentric, maybe weak, but he did have a vitality about him. And he did show a sense of leadership and an independence, which I think Iranians were counting on.
Also inspired a certain sense of nationalism. But on the other hand, weren't the clerics appalled by the Western-style secular changes that the Shah kept on putting into place?
They were, but the Ayatollahs, the clerics, were prepared to accommodate themselves with the Shah if he allowed them to more or less follow their religious pursuits, and the Shah tended to be fairly generous with them.
So why was so much of the leadership of the opposition out of the religious community?
Well, the key matter of the Mossadegh overthrow was there were two components to it. One was oil, of course, which the British were concerned about. The other was the Cold War, and the United States and particularly other NATO countries saw the Shah, saw Iran as a country in a very vital and important geographic location.
The Shah's widow came here to talk about a book she'd written about her life. And she said, well, you know, we made mistakes. The Savak should not have been so repressive, for example. I thought she was understating the case, obviously, and I'm sure a lot of Iranians felt the same way.
Yes, I read the book. It was a sympathetic account of her time in Tehran. And I think that element that of smoothing over the Savak's conduct or of saying we weren't aware of it, it doesn't necessarily ring true.
The revolution was backed by a wide range of dissatisfied Iranians. Were the diplomatic and intelligence communities keeping an eye on the role of the clerical community?
Yes, we were, but not to this, in retrospect, not to the extent we should have.
Well, the Ayatollah Khomeini had been giving anti-Shah speeches as early as the 1960s, and he was in exile in France, wasn't he? And they were sending tapes over, which seemed to be inspiring people.
Well, he was in exile, but and I think that everyone thought he was once removed. And in fact, if he would have stayed in Iraq rather than the Iranians asking him, asking the Iraqis to exile him, to move him, if he would have stayed in the region rather than go to Paris, he probably couldn't have pulled this off with the ease that he did. Because what he harnessed in Paris was the technological advances of the day in the West. And the cassettes, which you mentioned, were shipped in. They were played from the rooftops at top volume every night during the lead up to his arrival. So you can say, even though today there's a lot about social policy and technology, even then, which was roughly 1978, technology played a role.
Well, but were people in the intelligence community paying attention to this? Did they take it as seriously as they probably should have?
The people in the intelligence community, particularly with the embassies, were very circumscribed. The countries who were allies of the Shah were reluctant to probe very profoundly and very deeply. They worked largely with Savak, which, of course, was an end in itself. The thought that to go around Savak was seen as one way or the other being disloyal to the Shah.
My guest is former Canadian ambassador to Iran, Ken Taylor. He's the subject of a book by Robert Wright called Our Man in Tehran, the true story behind the secret mission to save six Americans during the Iran hostage crisis and the foreign ambassador who worked with the CIA to bring them home. It's published by Other Press. It is a book with perhaps the longest subtitle in the world. But you didn't write the book. You just cooperated with the book.
No, it's very much the fruit of Robert Wright's efforts, a gifted young historian who approached me about 3 years ago and said, I'm going to relook at the Iranian situation of 30 years ago, a sort of a commemoration. And I said, well, it's gone. It's in the background, but it's hardly current. He said, no, that there's Freedom of Information Act. People are more prepared to talk about it, that they were very guarded before. There's a book there.
And were documents being declassified because of FOIA, or was the government just ready to release certain information that had been keeping secret until then?
I think it was a progressive effort to unveil some history that didn't seem to be contentious at the time. People were asking questions. And then in the foreign ministries, particularly in Canada, they're continuing to review the data, which was classified, maybe overclassified in the first place, and then we're beginning to make it available.
Well, let's go back to you in Tehran. How long were you there when you began to see societal unrest there, and what were you saying in your communications with Ottawa at the time?
Well, initially, I was quite confident that the Shah would see his way through, that either he'd bring in a regency council or what have you. But once the riots started in the north, in Tabriz, even people in Tehran began to get very uneasy. And that would have been very early in 78. Mm. At that time, it was thought that if he consolidated the military influence, which he always had, if he pacified the church, the clerics, and if he modified his form of government and really had the parliament have a legitimate say, that he would be able to ride through the demonstrations, which were thought to be regional.
And was the Shah amenable to doing those things?
The Shah began during those during that period, 1978, became he lost his decisiveness to a certain degree. He seemed to be uneasy. He didn't appear in public as much as before. Not that, of course, he campaigned ever in the North American sense, but you felt that he was attempting to come to terms with accelerating change. And the general feeling was at that time among the Western community, including the USSR and the missions accomplished, associated with them, the journalists, the bankers, what have you, that he'd probably prevail.
Hmm. Although everybody saw this as an opportunity for getting something that they couldn't in the past. The Communist Party, for example, which had been suppressed in Iran, became part of the group that were demanding change. When did you start realizing that there might be a problem? Might be a problem for countries like Canada.
Certainly by summer, you saw the demonstrations were gaining momentum. They were becoming not only isolated in the north, but throughout Tehran. The tragic and terrible moment was during in the fall when the Rex Cinema burned down with the loss of 468 lives. That, in a sense, quite apart from the tragic loss of life, seemed to be a turning point in that are we in a lawless country? Are we in a country that is heading towards a deep and profound revolution?
Now, the Shah had physical problems, died not all that much after this. Do you think that's one of the reasons he was losing his decisiveness?
I would think so. I think that's a logical thought. That, of course, that he was ill was kept a secret. Very few people were aware of that, although some people thought that he did look wan and fatigued, but they attributed that to the stress and the strain of the unraveling situation.
Well, after he left Iran, thousands of revolutionaries hit the streets. What were they demanding?
After he left, they were concerned, I think, in a way. The Iranians have a as you mentioned earlier, memories of Mossadegh. And they could envisage the Shah going away, going to Cairo, and then through largely as they saw the British and the Americans involved being brought back as before. And that was the concern. But it moved on until, say, Khomeini arrived. The day Khomeini arrived, I was having lunch with some Iranian friends and then drove back to the office, and there was absolute pandemonium in the streets.
Joy?
Joy. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there were still sectors in Iran who were concerned about Khomeini and whatever influence he was going to bring to bear, and whether or not this was a revolution that most Iranians sought.
Well, the country had been secularized to some degree, and there was a large secular part of the Iranian population. I'd imagine they were afraid of exactly what's happening.
Very true. If the Shah's father, of course, had modeled Iran on Turkey, Ataturk, and he saw that a secular society was the society that he put into place and expected, of course, his son to pursue. So largely that part of the population, particularly some of the younger people, were hoped that the revolution and the change would be one that brought them not only liberty but freedom.
A lot of people don't remember this, but the American embassy was attacked in February 1979 by a communist group. Then Khomeini ordered their arrest and removal. Did that suggest to the Americans that they could breathe a bit easier?
Well, the irony of that was that the ambassador, William Sullivan, Bill Sullivan, advised or notified or made a call to Ibrahim Yazdi, who was at that time deputy undersecretary foreign affairs and was very close, one of Khomeini's closest secular relationship. The two-day party, as you mentioned earlier, was a threat to Khomeini's group. It wasn't all Khomeini, despite the fact of the extraordinary welcome he received. There were two or three other factors who saw a role for themselves and a very important and principal role.
So there's a power struggle going on immediately.
It was a power struggle.
And when they had the communists removed from the American embassy, Khomeini was just making sure that the clerics and their allies would be leading the revolution.
Well, that was in his intent, but that degree of accomplishment didn't become apparent until later in the year.
My guest is Ken Taylor, who was Canada's ambassador to Iran at the time of the revolution. He's also the subject of Robert Wright's book, Our Man in Tehran, The True Story Behind the Secret Mission to Save Six Americans During the Iran Hostage Crisis, and the Foreign Ambassador Who Worked with the CIA to Bring Them Home, published by Other Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ken Taylor, who was Canada's ambassador to Iran at the time of the Iranian Revolution, and the author of Our Man in Tehran, not Our Man in Havana, Our Man in Tehran, which is written by historian Robert Wright and published by Other Press. So suddenly chaos is reigning, and there's a power struggle going on. Was Ottawa concerned about the safety of the people at the embassy about Canadian citizens?
Yes, Canada, as the other countries, had heavy industrial interests, corporate interests in Iran. We had a pulp and paper mill, which was our pride and joy. This is something that we have a competence in. And we had roughly 1,800 Canadians in the north in a pulp and paper mill. The revolution, as it unfolded, put them in jeopardy, in danger. And so we had an evacuation plan, and we got them out through buses, through some havoc and chaos, safely to the airport, and we then brought in some Canadian military aircraft from Turkey. The odd thing is, it's not odd, but I guess it's right, is when as this situation unfolded, we heard from the relatives of those relatives from Canada. The other aspect was that a number of the people, of course, were very reluctant to leave. They had their assets. Maybe they were related to Iranian families. So you were caught between the embassy. We could only encourage the Canadians to leave, and we would let them know each individually because of a network of when the Canadian military planes were going to come in and take them out. After a point, there was still a residual number, and you conclude, well, it's up to you.
What about your staff?
Well, we cut down our embassy because there just wasn't the same pressure of work. We then, after cutting down the embassy, all dependents, except my own wife, who did leave periodically, evacuated, were sent back to Canada.
After the American embassy was taken over in early November, there was speculation that it really wasn't a student-led attack, but a carefully orchestrated one with Khomeini's support. What do you think now? What did you think then?
I think that there was Khomeini or his group had encouraged the takeover. A number of the students or militants or quasi-terrorists, however you want to label them, I think went in with an open mind. But most of them went in saying, we want to follow the line of the imam. And then, of course, what happened then is Khomeini was a very shrewd and manipulative politician, as well as an Ayatollah. And he, I think, saw the scene from apart, decided to take advantage of it. And as the months went on, he became the supreme leader. The other parties, particularly the Communist Party, the secular parties, what have you, just found themselves caught up in a sweep of influence and power by the Ayatollah.
Well, he was really, as you say, a very good politician. And you have to wonder what would be going on in Iran now if he were still alive rather than Khamenei being in power. He seems to be less capable of keeping things under control or unsure of where he wants to go.
Very true. And in the sense that Khamenei is less venerated. But also, he doesn't have the depth, he doesn't have the profundity that Khomeini had.
So let's talk about the diplomats who wound up in the Canadian embassy. When did you find out that five diplomats had escaped?
A couple of days after the embassy was taken over, maybe 4 or 5 days after they'd taken over, they phoned my colleague, one of them, the chief consular officer, phoned my colleague, John Sheardown, and said they're on the run and they've got no place to go.
They'd left the American embassy
and they were just hiding
in friends' homes?
No, they knew where some empty apartments of the U.S. diplomats who were held in the embassy were located. And they went from one to two, but they had no money. They had no provisions. The country was in an uproar. There were vigilantes at every street corner. So they were looking for what you could call a safe haven.
Was there any hesitation on your part to take them in?
I mean, your
embassy was essentially going to be compromised. Your primary duty was to protect the interests of Canada and Canadians.
Yes, but there was also a diplomatic aspect to it. The country is in disarray. Diplomatic community had disappeared, and you put yourself in their situation. There was also a lot of basic instinct involved. Here's a situation. People are on the run. They're innocent. They're like us diplomats. They're also from the United States. This is what we wanted to do. It's what the prime minister wanted to do and concurred with. And so then we took them in.
And then the sixth came to you later?
Yes, they came. They came that same day.
I imagine the thought of being discovered weighed heavily on you every minute of a day. How did you operate under that kind of pressure?
Well, it was sort of bizarre because they came as four stayed in the Sheardown's home, and they were there in undercover, and the Sheardowns didn't entertain. I was still trying to run some sort of embassy-type operation. So they stayed upstairs when we had guests, and our people who worked at the house, Pat, my wife, encouraged them to think of the visitors as tourists.
So because there were any number of Iranians working in the embassy, I would assume there were a few of them.
At our residence, there were eight Iranians working.
So you weren't worried that they might tell somebody that?
Yes, but we trusted them, and we tried to convey a sense of relaxation that, yes, these people are staying with us, they're here indefinitely. They had some questions, but what a dedicated group of people they were. They never really said a word to anybody.
My guess is Ken Taylor, who is the subject of Robert Wright's new book called Our Man in Tehran, published by Other Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is it true that at least one Canadian journalist knew about the Americans in hiding?
Yes, I'm Jean Peltier from La Presse. And as the story has developed over the years, other U.S. journalists, other than the Canadian, had an idea and had an impression that we did have some diplomats with us, because some did arithmetic and counted back and found where have these six people disappeared. But in a sense, it was a very responsible press. They kept it to themselves. La Presse particularly, the publisher and Peltier, decided to hold it until there was a break. And then once the news came out, they were first to run it.
Didn't Peter Jennings come to your house?
Yes, Peter was a
good
friend.
He was at ABC?
Yes, he was a good friend, and it pained me not to to tell him. He's of course, I've known him for some years. He's from Ottawa. And he at that time, I think, was at the London Bureau of the television group, and so was in Tehran indefinitely. And we saw him frequently, and it was with some sort of chagrin after we saw him in London that he sort of understood, but he would have liked to have known.
What was your relationship with the new forming government like?
Well, you tried to do your best to get to know them, to what's going on here. You tried to probe a bit, but of the bureaucratic structure, everyone was afraid to make a decision. You couldn't even hardly talk about the weather. Mm-hmm. It was the sense that you'd either find yourself in Evine prison, or you'd find yourself ostracized, or what have you. The consequences were severe. And one remark, though telling remark, that I found was with my conversation with Yazdi, who was one of the senior Khomeini entourage, that they were astonished that they'd arrived in Iran so early. They thought that it would take 3 or 4 years of assiduous work and propaganda in Paris before they were able to come to Tehran.
They thought the Shah would be able to hold on to power longer.
Yes, they were as in a sense, as maybe as surprised as we were at the rapid collapse.
So these people are now hiding away in your embassy. How soon before you came up with the plan to get them out?
Well, after a while, we had some proposals as to how to get them out, but they're U.S. diplomats. It wasn't our decision to make. So we proposed some means, and then our department in Ottawa spoke to Washington and said, what do you have in mind? This is what we have. So they then, the CIA, worked with imagination and what have you with our people in Ottawa and came up with a scheme that these diplomats, in essence, were members of a documentary team that were portraying a true picture of the revolution, and they were all from Canada.
So they got fake passports that had been made by the CIA, fake visa stamps, and then they they were couriered through Canada, and then they wound up able to leave. Was there concern for the remaining hostages, given that the news of 6 Americans fleeing Iran would probably break after they were safely in the West?
Yes, there was a concern and a preoccupation.
And then what about you? Because it would come out and...
Well, myself and the two communicators and one of the military police and one of my diplomatic colleagues, Roger Lucy, stayed behind that day. The U.S. diplomats plus the two CIA officers who had come over that weekend left in the morning. We left in late afternoon.
Well, I would imagine all foreigners were being watched very closely.
Yes, they were. But we thought that it's not that difficult for an American to pass as a Canadian.
We talked about the declassified documents. They revealed that you played a more active role in collecting intelligence for the United States than some had thought. In fact, were you, as many have called you, working as a de facto CIA station chief in Tehran?
No, that's not a bad designation, I guess, in some books. But the situation was that the CIA or any other intelligent operatives from the Pentagon or what have you, there was nobody in Iran at the moment. The desk was clear. So in anticipation of Eagle Claw, the commando raid, the U.S. needed some intelligence. President Carter asked Prime Minister Clark if we could carry this out. Myself and a military police officer, Jim Edwards from Canada, plus one addition, a CIA intelligence officer who joined the embassy, worked on the plans, put together the details of the compound, how many Iranians were there, what sort of armaments they had, what were their schedules in anticipation of the raid. So that aspect probably over the last 2 months was more preoccupying to me and had different consequences than maybe the hiding the 6.
The CIA was able to eventually send an agent codenamed Bob into Tehran.
Well, Bob was the CIA agent who worked with me. Yeah. Yes, he came and he came to the embassy, and a remarkable, remarkable agent.
You left Iran a hero in the world's eyes, but some have criticized you, saying that you may have taken too much personal credit for something that was a broad collaborative effort. What do you say to that, and how do you respond to the fact that Stansfield Turner, the director of the CIA at the time, someone who benefited from your intelligence gathering, failed to give you any credit in his memoir?
Well, I think Stanfield Turner did to some degree. To me, it's a question of perception. The CIA's role, which was crucial in putting together the exit strategy, didn't come out till 4 or 5 years later when President Carter talked about it after he left. But there was an involvement by the Canadians through the entire 3 months. As it happens, one individual is oftentimes selected and either takes the blame or takes the credit. In my own way, you accept that, and you also accept the criticism that you are taking too much credit. So it's a halfway point. The operation itself was a simple story with a good conclusion, and there's enough credit to go around to everybody.
Did this really mess up Canadian-Iranian relations for a while?
Well, they weren't very warm to start with, and I think you'd call them neutral to cold at the moment.
To this day, are they still angry?
Well, not necessarily about that, but there's been other aspects of Canadian policy which aggravates the Iranians. One is that Canada brings up each year charges at the UN about their human rights records.
And Canadians have been held.
Canadians have been held. In fact, one journalist, of course, lost her life in Tehran, which Canadian authorities suspect was a fatal beating.
You retired from the Foreign Service only a few years after you'd served in Iran. Where had you gone after?
I went across the U.S. and Canada speaking about diplomacy, what have you, for a year, opening some parades, what have you, until the public got tired of me, I think. And at that point, I then became Consul General in New York. And after a few years, I decided just to try something else. So I resigned, and after what I found was a fun-filled diplomatic career, and went into business.
Do you still follow what's going on in Iran closely?
No, closely. I mean, once the country is very seductive, it's a remarkable country in that sense. The fact that it did have an empire almost three times over.
But still seems to be very resentful of the West and seems to blame it for everything that's gone wrong over the last 2,000 years.
Yes, I think our hope is that, and I think this is what those associated with the Green Revolution, if you can call the uprising over the fraudulent election, hope for some opening, hope for some justice that would allow them, and freedom to allow them to use that overworked word, but it's a good one, engaged with the West.
Did you feel, just judging from what you're seeing now, that you were dealing with more competent people at the time? Right now you have the whole thing with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He may play well in some parts of Iran, but the rest of the world sees him as something of a buffoon.
Well, I agree. How at the moment, it's very difficult to negotiate with the Iranians. First, who's in charge? And secondly, do they bring a bias which makes it almost impossible to come to a logical conclusion or a view which takes care of both interests?
Well, there are chips on everybody's shoulders in this story, aren't there? After all, Americans were held hostage in the embassy for 444 days. That's a long time.
But if you look at the aftermath of World War II, it didn't take that long with respect to Japan and Germany. And here we are 30 years later.
Still having problems with Iran.
Still having problems.
Ken Taylor was the Canadian ambassador to Iran at the time of the 1979 revolution. He's the subject of a book by Robert Wright called Our Man in Tehran. And it is published by Other Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, enjoyed it.